As our leaders consider how or whether to acknowledge Indigenous Australians in the Constitution as the first people on this continent, here is a figure that should never cease to shock us into action. Indigenous Australians are 12 times more likely to be in jail than non-Indigenous Australians. 24 times more likely if you're an Indigenous teenager. Two-thirds of all women in prison in this country are Indigenous. How to turn this around will be discussed this afternoon in an important forum at the University of New South Wales, headlined by former High Court Judge Michael Kirby. It's an event that's happening as part of NAIDOC Week. NAIDOC is about celebration, but it's also about tough conversations. And joining me this morning is Dr. Megan Williams. She's a public health policy specialist and lecturer in the Indigenous Health Unit Murrumurri in the UNSW's Department of Medicine or Faculty of Medicine. Good morning to you.
Morning, thanks.
Congratulations on the PhD work too.
Thank you.
Great to have you in the studio. Chris Kinnean joins us too. He's Professor of Criminology at the University of New South Wales. And these stats are something he knows inside out. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Hi, Natasha.
This question, why is this nation jailing so many Indigenous people at this rate? What are the stories behind these statistics?
Well, there's a lot of stories behind
them.
There
are many stories. Some are about the individual, some are about the social parameters, but there are other things going on too, aren't there?
Yeah, and look, you know, it's not something that happened yesterday. You know, it's a long-term problem which successive federal governments and state governments of various political hues have failed to resolve. I mean, we've seen these increases in Indigenous imprisonment in Australia continuously over the period since around the mid-1980s. And we also obviously need to put in a much longer-term context. We know that the extreme marginalisation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australian society is something that is really derived from a much longer colonial experience. It's something that's not particular to Australia. We see, perhaps not as extreme, but similar situations in the US, Canada, New Zealand that have had very similar histories of dispossession, attempted extermination, and quite extreme forms of racially based control over Indigenous groups.
And there's a deep history.
There is a very deep history. And so we can look at it, you know, over the last 20 years, but it actually rests and derives from a much deeper problem about the nature of Australian society. And you know, it's a problem that's not removed from the discussions yesterday in Kirribilli House about the recognition of Aboriginal people, about the acknowledgement of Aboriginal people.
That's not going to pull, even if that was to happen tomorrow, that's not going to pull those two-thirds of women who are incarcerated, who are Indigenous in our jails, out of jail.
No, it's not. But, you know, the foundations need to be built on respect for Indigenous culture and Indigenous people. And until we do that, we won't turn around imprisonment rates. We won't turn around problems with housing, with health, with employment. They're interrelated. They're quite clearly closely interrelated, and they find their most extreme form behind prison bars where there are so many Indigenous people.
So many Indigenous people, but young people in particular. Yeah. So Indigenous kids and women in particular.
Yeah.
Is that unusual to Australian Indigenous people, or is it an international story?
Look, we've seen increases in women's imprisonment across Western countries in recent years. And again, you know, what happens is that those increases fall most heavily on the shoulders of the most marginalised groups within society, and that's precisely what's happened in relation to Aboriginal women in this country, that women's imprisonment rate's gone up generally in Australia, but it's gone up much more quickly for Aboriginal women, and that has disastrous effects on families, on children and on communities. And again, it's not unrelated to those figures that we see for Indigenous children and the incarceration of Indigenous children. We know that for Aboriginal kids, many have the experience of either having, at the moment, having a parent in prison or having had a parent in prison. And so, again, they're interrelated. And all the international research shows, irrespective of whether you're Indigenous or not, if you've got a parent in prison, that's a high predictor that you'll become involved in the juvenile justice system.
Yes, we might talk about that, because then it becomes sort of normalised to
Absolutely.
Have family members end up in jail. Megan Williams, your PhD looked at a whole range of things. What was the core focus?
My core focus was listening to the stories of Aboriginal people directly. I believe, and as do the elders, that our peoples hold the answers to these over-incarceration rates. So I started by listening to the stories of people who'd been out of prison for more than 2 years. Mm. And I asked them, what types of supports helped you to prevent going back into prison? Some had been out for 2 years, some for 10 years.
So they'd broken the cycle and that was the key.
They were the people who'd so-called broken the cycle. Mm. And it was a fantastic opportunity to inquire how and what worked. Mm. And the second round of interviewing work that I did for the PhD was to then listen to the Aboriginal elders and health workers and all of those who've provided support through services, mainly through Aboriginal community-controlled services, whether that's in health or in justice.
And in fact, the role of elders became a vital thread in your analysis, didn't it?
It did.
The absolutely vital role in elders being present and available to those who are in jail, who come out of jail.
It's really such a privilege. Those elders are extraordinarily resilient. Often they've had experiences themselves of being removed as children, having been in juvenile detention and in prison. And then maybe they return to education, whether that's in TAFE or university, or they have a long history of work experience in services, and they go on to become community leaders, and they end up on Premier's advisory committees or policy and other governance roles as well. Mm. So, you know, from those, you know, very extremely humble and challenging and traumatic circumstances, they're very resilient and have really keen insight into the lives of Aboriginal young people today.
So just backtracking a bit, one argument that you, or case that you make, is for more residential drug and alcohol rehabilitation that involves Indigenous elders. Let's just step back one notch, because part of what you looked at too was the role that drug and alcohol is playing in the sort of stats that we're seeing in Indigenous imprisonment.
Yeah, we've got reasonable figures, Chris, about the involvement of drug and alcohol in people's incarceration, and they're really quite high. I think the majority of people are at some point sentenced in relation to drug and alcohol issues.
Do you want to add to that, Chris?
Look, I just do agree, really. I mean, you know, it's clearly, it clearly impacts on people's behaviour, the behaviour which come before the courts. And there's a clear need for, I think Megan's point's fundamentally important around drug and alcohol rehabilitation centres that are Indigenous run, preferably Indigenous run. And, you know, we don't have that. I mean, we do have some cases, but not nearly enough for the size of the problem.
What's the evidence to suggest that that would make a difference?
Well, I guess the evidence in the Western science method is scant.
Because people haven't asked the question.
No, that's right. And there are so few Aboriginal-led residential rehabilitation settings. And unfortunately, one that I'd personally been involved in has had to close its doors. You know, they're really very challenged by funding and challenged by quality assurance and adhering to, I guess, you know, certain standards and reporting. And but those rehabilitation centres have been able to involve elders as well as peer-based models. And the peer-based education and support has been, you know, instrumental in other areas of healthcare, like reducing HIV and hepatitis C transmission. Mm. And we've got really good evidence that peer support and peer education works. And that evidence really is fairly transferable over to the residential rehabilitation setting, as is mentoring. We've got, you know, evidence worldwide about the use of mentoring. So if we can sort of sketch together a bit of a patchwork quilt of evidence.
But what in terms of, you know, addressing the drug and alcohol related issues for ex-prisoners, ex-cons, so to speak, why is it vital that that happens in an Indigenous context? What's not happening now that means that people can't break that cycle?
Well, one is the history of a family that leads an individual to having alcohol and drug-related dependency and risk too. Usually there's a couple of generations of family trauma that's been experienced, that a person kind of embodies and takes on and doesn't really understand how that trauma's woven into their own conditioning. And it's that conditioning that is so, I guess, deeply wound into a person that takes a lot of work and a lot of support and a lot of tools and strategies to get insight into. And for the elders, they usually know the story of a person's family, including the country that they're from, maybe country that they've been removed from, and their parents' stories. So a younger person's able to hear and listen to that story and help locate themselves in that, as well as learn more about the history of this country. Often Aboriginal people, young people, don't really know that. And that's a story that's not told generally in mainstream education settings. And it's so incredibly painful to also talk about in Aboriginal family contexts
as
well.
And this is part of your research suggests that we do need to focus more on the family of the person in jail and leaving jail much as the individual themselves.
That's right. And it's not a new idea. There's a beautiful quote from an American author and an English author, and about needing to prepare the community to which people return, and that we need to do more work on the community side of the fence as well, not just the individual leaving prison. And there's been a number of projects in Sydney, at the Aboriginal Medical Service of Western Sydney, you know, that's threatened with closing its doors at the moment. They came up with a coordinated care management working with Aboriginal women in prison and following them through by visiting in prison and doing coordinated case planning and then supporting them through exit into whatever steps they needed to take next, whether that was rehabilitation, whether that was just sort of rejoining the family, or whether that was education and training, and then following up for quite a long time. And my research was able to show that through care model of service needs to occur for a very long time in a person's life, because we're talking about a long history of conditioning in often in trauma, and a long process of learning about oneself, and then a long process of finding one's feet. And support is integral, and we need many different forms of support.
Yes, Dr. Megan Williams is with us, public health policy specialist, lecturer in the Indigenous Health Unit at Murrumbarri at the University of New South Wales. Chris Kinnean, professor of criminology, is with us too from the University of New South Wales. We're talking about the enormous rates of incarceration of Indigenous Australians. You're 24 times more likely to be in jail if you're an Indigenous teenager than if you're a non-Indigenous teenager. And this is where, Chris, this idea of the new normal, you know, that incarceration is part of every family story now. And I wonder if that then just becomes something that kids expect for themselves.
Look, I think that's a problem. I mean, there are other issues as to why there's so many Aboriginal young people coming into juvenile justice, and I think we need to look critically at the way the justice system works. We know that Aboriginal kids, for instance, don't get the same advantage of diversionary options away from children's court systems as non-Indigenous kids do, so they're more likely to be pushed through to the harder end. And I think that's something that says something about the way the way non-Indigenous people see Aboriginal young people, and I think that it's quite clear they get more harsh or harsher outcomes than non-Indigenous kids.
So can we call that racism?
Well, you can certainly call it indirect racism if it's not direct. I think that it's an indirect outcome of the way the processes work. I mean, we've seen Western Australia's mandatory sentencing regimes, which we know impacts negatively on Aboriginal kids. So there's a whole range of things that we could do to reform the justice system, to improve the way it works. Remand for adults had a negative impact on Aboriginal adults. There's a range of reforms that could be undertaken. But I just to go back to Megan's point around rehabilitation. I mean, one of the kind of disasters of the more punitive policies around law and order is that we've been spending more and more money on prison. And that really limits the amount of money that we can put into these non-custodial residential facilities or therapeutic programs. We spend billions at the moment locking people up. It's very expensive to lock people up, as we all know.
Yeah, but it's tough for policymakers because they've got, you know, crime rates that they need to respond to.
But crime rates have been falling. I mean, that's the irony in all of this, is that over the last 15 years, crime rates in general have been going down. So, you know, the trend is in crime rates is inverse to what's been happening with prison rates.
And, in terms of Indigenous incarceration.
So. And generally, yeah.
What about this work that Megan's been doing on involving elders in the process? There are some good examples of elders being a part of the court system and working with Indigenous offenders.
Yeah, look, there's some very good examples, and we've seen around the late 1990s onwards, we've had about 15 or 16 years experience now of various forms of Aboriginal sentencing courts. So they're called different things in different states, the Murray Court, the Koori Court, circle sentencing. And that directly involves elders with the magistrate in looking at a more therapeutic way of responding to an individual offender rather than simply, you know, getting you 2 minutes before the magistrate, getting a sentence handed down at the end. What happens is that the elders are actually able to engage the offender and the family and the community and look at some
big burden on the elders.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Big burden on the elders.
Yeah.
And look at... Sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, I was simply going to say that we've actually seen a move away from that. I mean, nastier examples of public policy in Queensland under the Campbell Newman government was to abolish the Murray Court there. I'm not aware if the Labor Party's reintroduced it, but you know, you've had a move away from involving the elders in these processes, even though we know in the longer term it enables Aboriginal governance, it helps the community build itself, and it brings the community into this process.
And does it hold those individuals accountable for their crimes?
Actually, I would argue that it holds them more accountable.
Because they're accountable to their community, yeah, as much as the system.
Oh, look, I've been the Murray Courts that I've sat in on in Queensland are very intense. They go for a long period of time. There's real engagement with the person that's appearing before them compared to the Magistrates Court where it's, yeah, it has to be a sausage machine or it'd collapse, you know, yeah, where you'd be there for a couple of minutes.
Final comment from you, Megan, on that.
I worked alongside some of the Murray Court elders in Queensland, and not only did they appear in court, but they usually reviewed papers for a couple of days beforehand and appeared in court and then followed up with family members, explained to all the different members what the process was from here, even at the supermarket. And these are, you know, Aboriginal elders whose life is seamless. They don't segment the personal and the professional, and they're able to work alongside the family for long periods of time.
Oh, there's so much more to this, and I think we might have to get you back on to talk about the specifics of those Murray Court or Koori Court or circle sentencing processes, because they're very interesting to me. Chris Kinnean, a Professor of Criminology at the University of New South Wales, Dr. Megan Williams, Public Health Policy Specialist in the Indigenous Health Unit, Maury Murray at UNSW as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very
Natasha.
Much.
Hey, happy NAIDOC Week. It's not a happy topic though, is it? But it's a vital one. Books and Arts coming your way next with Michael Cathcart and, a NAIDOC-themed program. Somewhat?
Yes, we're going to remember The Intervention, which was 8 years ago. There's an anthology of people, of writers about the intervention and what it's meant and what its legacy has been. And we're going to do this. The Rocky Horror
Show. It's just a step to the left.
Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, I've got the words wrong, but God, I love that.
Oh, you're doing well. You're doing well. Are you dressed for the part?
No, I'm not, actually.
Oh, dear.
Is it 40 years on? Rocky
40
Horror.
40 years.
Since the Rocky Horror Show. That's coming up next. Books and Arts on RN with Michael Cathcart. Bye from me.